Welcome to Roanoke Collaboration Project Radio, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story for Radio Melrose. Today we're joined by
Dana Ackley, author of A Little Book to Save Humanity.
Wayne Strickland, former Executive Director of the Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission.
Catherine Elam, former Director of Junior Achievement of Southwest Virginia.
Bill Lee, retired pastor of Loudoun Avenue Christian Church.
Cynthia Lawrence, head of workforce development at Carilion Clinic.
William Fralin, former member of the Virginia House of Delegates.
Michael Brockta, CIA retired and past president of the Kiwanis Club of Roanoke.
And you can follow us at roanokecollaboration.org. Today we're going to discuss a story by Radio IQ. A new minimum wage bill has passed the Virginia House of Delegates.
Hampton Democratic Delegate Gian Ward led the charge as Virginia's House of Delegates voted along party lines to pass a new minimum wage Tuesday. It'll bring the lowest possible pay in the Commonwealth to $15 an hour by 2028 and set the minimum wage to the Consumer Price Index after that. Ward's effort comes after former Governor Glenn Youngkin vetoed her same effort in recent years, what she said was the first veto of legislation she sponsored in her over 20-year career in office.
I kept thinking, I'll be back. But he won't.
She also said it fits into Governor Abigail Spanberger's affordability agenda.
She wants an affordable Virginia, one where all hardworking people can make a living, not only live, but to thrive in this Commonwealth.
Every Republican in the chamber voted against the measure. Bristol Delegate Israel O'Quinn said most employers, even in his rural section of the state, were likely already paying more than $15 an hour, but he's still worried for small business owners along the state's borders.
I'll tell you that in our area, where Tennessee is just mere steps away, there are a lot of people who are actively looking at that because not all parts of the Commonwealth are exactly the same. You know, you can get hokey and use alliteration, which I'll do. Bristol isn't Bristow. Arlington isn't Abingdon.
The bill now heads to the Senate, where it'll likely pass along party lines. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Okay, so minimum wage is something that's often discussed in the General Assembly. It hasn't been raised for quite some time, if I remember correctly. As an aside, I will say I served with Gian, and it was great to hear her voice. I haven't seen her in a long time. So any thoughts about raising the minimum wage? Who would be against that? Mike?
You know, when we talk about raising the minimum wage, I think it might be helpful to understand who we're talking about. And it's my understanding that about two-thirds of the people that are affected by this minimum wage discussion, two-thirds of the population that are affected, are in the hospitality industry, restaurants, hospitality. So I think that's the segment of society who would have the most interest in the outcome of this discussion.
You know, one of the things that strikes me, and this is the argument you often hear from the other side, I don't think Israel O'Quinn was talking more about competition with Tennessee, but if you're trying to create an affordable environment where things are more affordable, and one of your major components is labor costs, and you raise labor costs, some would say artificially, the market is what the market is, and what we're doing is we're setting a floor to the market. You can, in fact, increase prices. Is anybody swayed by that argument at all?
Well, it almost makes sense,
Catherine,
that it will happen that way, because you've got to figure out a balance some way or another to be able to offer the wages that individuals need to be able to survive from day to day. I think about the industry with childcare. I mean, that's a big deal. You want people who are capable, who are there and influencing our young people, and they're in that childcare setting. And yet, that's one of the poorest paid positions there is out there. And of course, along with that, there's been legislation and other things that have gone in hand where the persons who are doing the care for the students and young people need to also have additional training to make sure they're staying on top of things and keeping our young people engaged. So I think all that, you do find it sort of a balance act you have to come up with. Of course, you're going to have to pay more.
Bill?
So I, the argument to raise minimum wage is one piece, but there's no conversation about whether there are benefits with the raising of the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So if health insurance is not there, no retirement plan is there, then you raise my mean income, eggs price is going to go up, So whatever I make, I'm going to lose along the way. It's not so much minimum wage that I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about whether the person has some kind of benefit package with that, which then causes another whole issue with employers because there's a cost. But I think it's an equity justice piece for me that a person come to the end of their career that they ought to have something to be able to live on by way of retirement and be able to go to get a decent checkup because they got medical care.
Wayne?
And we've talked about this before in other sessions, that you know more than half of the families in Roanoke live paycheck to paycheck. And I think it's a sad situation when you're being paid $10 an hour, $12 an hour, that you can't make it. And so, as Bill said, and you don't get any benefits with it as well. But what happens when you have when your car stops or when you have a medical bill to pay? Something needs to be done to raise your income a bit to cover some of that.
Yeah, you know, trying to support yourself, much less a family, on $15 an hour, which is would be the new minimum wage under the law, is difficult. I think opponents might say these are mostly entry-level jobs. These are jobs getting started. These are not jobs that are designed to support families, for example. Whether that's a fair argument or not, I don't know. But I do know that if the labor cost goes up and you can't afford to pay a certain wage, you can either cut the jobs, right, reduce the number of jobs you're going to put out there, or you can increase the hours. So I don't know, Cynthia.
Right, thanks. You know, I think in most cases, all small business owners want to be able to care for their workforce, to provide a wage that will not only provide a living, but allow the family to thrive and to so that they can affordably remain loyal to that small business. That is the heart and soul of commerce. When you start adjusting base pay rates in a larger company, you run the risk of having an impact to the financials of millions of dollars when you are adjusting in any incremental fashion. And to Bill's point, I think employers absolutely want to deliver the whole package, benefits, insurance, any other supportive services that employees would need to live comfortably and well and concentrate on their career and their families. So I think the debate is certainly worthy of having. I think that all of our costs have gone up across the gamut, from basic living expenses to the cost of insurance and all of those things that are wrapped into compensation. But I think that would then go back to our basic question: when we're talking about minimum wage, are we talking about the whole compensation package? And how does that impact livability and affordability?
So, Cynthia, what I hear you saying is this is sort of the rising tide lifts all boats in a way that's going to cost businesses a lot of money. So they may not be paying much for the minimum wage worker, or they may not even have workers at minimum wage.
Right.
But if that goes up, then that's going to put pressure on the next job tier, because they have to be paid more to keep that differential in place?
That's right. Okay. And most businesses will do an annual cost of living adjustment when they look at the inflation index or any sort of price increases. They'll do an across the board. That doesn't always fix the problems, but I think employers on the whole want to bring a balanced financial picture and a balanced compensation package to their folks that work for them.
Okay. Dana?
I look at this a little differently. As I've listened to you talk so far, each of you have been making predictions about how this change is going to impact behavior. In the news story, they said all the Republicans voted against it. So we could easily, from that, make the case that Republicans hate poor people. I'm not convinced that that's actually the case. It is that they are using a different way of thinking about behavior than the Democrats are. So they make different predictions about how every time one passes a law, you're making a prediction about how people are going to respond to that new law. There are a lot of bad laws that get passed because they are based on very uninformed understandings of how people actually operate.
Sometimes there are, and one of the jobs in the legislature is to guard against unintended consequences.
When will they start? I'm sorry.
Well, ever since I left, I'm sure they don't do as good a job as they used to. Yeah. Mike?
You know, I'm still drawn to the observation that the segment of the population that we're talking about here, the segment that's most affected by a conversation about minimum wage, is the hospitality and restaurant business. These are people who, in all aspects of every city, every community, including ours, important aspects of our community. So when we think about what their life is like and what the possibility brings to them of an increase in minimum wage, all right, we should also think about the impact on their employers. Now, some of us suggested the impact might go beyond dollars and cents. It might include benefits. I get that, all right? But this is not the first conversation that's been held in the United States about increasing minimum wage. To Dana's point, there's lots of information available about what happens when you increase minimum wage. We don't have to speculate. Anybody know what those impacts are?
I think he's asking the group.
That would be a no on your part, William.
I'm not sure that was rhetorical. Rhetorical questions aren't great for the radio. Yeah, Wayne.
Cynthia had a good point. You have to think about the employer. I mean, our economy is driven by small business for the most part. And think about the fact that they're paying higher wages, but then you see other legislation coming through requiring 2 weeks of paid leave for people, and that is a costly process, and all the companies will have to try to figure out how to pay for all this stuff that's coming through our legislature.
Right. You're listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, rather, where we discuss issues of local importance as heard through stories on Radio IQ and broadcast on Radio Melrose. Bill.
So in response to Mike, I've got two responses. One, the cost of raising minimum wage is going to be passed on to people like us. I was conscious of that before anyone raised. Whenever I go to the restaurant, my wife and I, we're going to tip at the highest level we can tip because, again, it's a justice issue for me. I have the means. I'm not going to go and have a person waiting on me and not leave that. So money's going to come out of my pocket, but it's going to come out of all of us. Anybody who claims middle class, upper middle class, whatever you call it, we're going to pay. The folk in the middle have been carrying the country forever. We're going to keep doing that. The other piece that I'm concerned about, I don't know what the threshold is. If you make a certain amount of money, especially for a single parents, especially single parent women, whatever aid they're receiving will be impacted by the fact they're making more money. Which is an interesting thing. You're making more money, but it may cost you in the long run. So I think that's something, especially the people who listen to us, the people that I know at the intersections of Melrose and Orange, people who are living in Lansdowne and Lincoln Terrace, people who are living in my neighborhood, which is a place where you drive with two-car garages and et cetera, it may cost people if they're making more money. So then the person has to decide, do I want to make more money? Does that help my intrinsic value? Or do I need aid to dependent children? I don't want my Medicaid cut. All those pieces may be impacted. I don't know what the threshold is, but that's something I think we need to be conscious of.
Well, I hadn't really thought of that, but that could be an unintended consequence, yep. Right? And I don't know how the public benefits work with in terms of having a work requirement, at least looking for work and all that. So, yeah, Dana.
I happen to know that the threshold for Medicaid for a single person is $22,000. Try living on that.
Right. Well, that's right. Well, you can't. That's why they get Medicaid, though. Right.
Yep.
I mean, right. Yeah, Wayne.
Well, you know, Mike had an interesting point that we have been talking about at the federal level, minimum wage. And after two decades of discussion, we're still at less than $8 an hour. And now the states are having to t- try to compensate for that. So
that's definitely the case, and that's been part of the logjam in the federal government. It sounds like, yeah, Mike.
Right, we are at $7.25 an hour at the federal government. It's been that way for quite some time. So my point earlier, this conversation has played out in many places before it's playing out here today in this radio station. So think about it now. We know that small businesses are the ones that are fueling the economy that's associated with hospitality and restaurant. So really, we're talking about the impact to a small business of having to pay their employees more money, right? What is that impact to that small business?
You know, and often we talk about small businesses, and small businesses for sure are the largest employers in the country and in Virginia. But I think sometimes we think that, well, it's a big business, so obviously they can afford it because they're a big business. But if they have an expense X that rises to Y, they're going to cut Q somewhere, or it's going to come out of their owner's pockets, one or the other. Cynthia?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was just thinking about the market forces, back to the federal minimum wage that you just brought up. You know, I think the Republican point of view is that the free market will help level set what is a competitive wage. And right now, we are in a workers' market because we have jobs that need skilled labor, professionals, and we have a mismatch of skills and open jobs. And so at this point, I think the market is dictating a higher wage than even the minimum wage that we're talking about.
Yeah, that may be. And I'm sure that Jay Lark and have done studies on the minimum wage, which is the research arm of the General Assembly. And I didn't hear from the story, and if I was asking the question, I would ask about the state government and what this would cost the state government because of the wage pressure, because the state employs a lot of people. So it'd be interesting. Yeah, Dana.
Well, that is interesting. There's another aspect of this that comes to mind as I'm listening, and that is the growing wealth disparity in our country. And those organizations that serve that growing wealth disparity are eating their seed corn, because it is the general public that they need for their customers. And if the customers can't exist, then it's a very short-term solution that they're pursuing.
Right, right. Bill.
So there's another way to look at this for me. Okay, so these are entry-level jobs, low-paying jobs. Suppose we were smart enough to say, okay, we're going to put you on a career path, highway, that we know you're working these jobs, but let this not be your end goal. What if in Roanoke we could come up with a model with all of our employers and say, hey, we're going to start grabbing these folk and say, look, we know you're struggling, but we've got a program for you that'll move you from the $15 to ultimately getting $25 out, but you got to work. And the work I'm talking about is not the labor. It's going to class. It's going to the higher ed center. It's being in a business that has programs that make you climb. I think part of my struggle with minimum wage is that persons live into that. And it devalues them, it brings them down, rather than seeing, I can do something else. And some just wondering, I have this thing about Roanoke, that Roanoke is big enough to be a city, but small enough to know that people can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And maybe we might come up with a model. I just threw that
out.
You
know, that's interesting. When you were talking about that, Bill, I was thinking, my mind immediately went to the CAP program, the Community College Access Program, where anybody that graduates from a Roanoke City public school, and I think it might be wider than that now, goes to community college for free.
Yes.
Now, that you can't eat that, right? You can't. That doesn't pay your rent. Right. That doesn't get you there, but it does take care of that cost. Does that impact what you're talking about?
Yeah, and you can be hired while you're going to school.
Yeah. True. So that's what I'm thinking. I sat on that the committee at Virginia Western with the CCAP, And I was just shocked at persons who would not fill out the forms. Again, there's a lot of stuff. Persons felt that if I fill out these forms for my children and say how much money I'm making, somehow the government is going to take something from me. So there's a lot of work we need to still do. But I think, for me, that we can get people on a pathway that then maybe rather than needing 10 people to do a job, you need 3 because you've got persons who are going somewhere as opposed to somebody saying, I'm just going in here because I have nothing else to do. Maybe. I'm not.
Sounds good. Catherine?
Well, on that same note, I worked with Junior Achievement, and that was one of our big things, is about making sure that our young people understood how to enter the workforce, how to manage their money, and talk about entrepreneurship. And so, again, what we have luckily going on in our schools is to make sure that our young people understand the professions that are actually going to pay them decent wages, but also they're taking the courses that they need as well. So I think that's partly one of the things I looked at, and I know I remember clearly that for a while there, we had students that were interested in welding, and they were actually able to go right out into the community and start working with a mentor and learn how to earn that money.
Catherine, why don't you take a minute, just 30 seconds, explain Junior Achievement in 30 seconds, I think, for our listeners, to make sure everybody knows.
The best part of that is that we actually relied on the community as well as corporations to give us individuals that came from all the industries to go into a classroom and actually mentor the students and get them prepared so that they had a real-world vision versus the television version of what their job would be. And I think that was the biggest part of it. And they were able to continue to understand and go behind the doors of a lot of the corporations here that even as adults, we don't realize what we actually produce in this valley. So it was a great opportunity, again, for entrepreneurship, the whole thing on financial literacy, and again, for workforce readiness.
Dana?
Catherine, let me ask you a question. To what extent do our local school systems provide classes to teach some of these basic life skills, or are they counting on you guys?
Well, I think for the most part, you have the career technical courses, and those are the most vibrant that are going on in almost every school system right now. So that career technical is a great way for people to understand and take the classes, whether it's going to be auto mechanics, culinary, whatever it may be. They can all have that exposure, and then they find something that they enjoy. My thought is you get to learn that, and then maybe it's a hobby of yours, but it then also can supplement your income once you get out.
But about 100% of students need to learn how to manage their money.
Correct.
Well, Cynthia wants to jump in here. I know she's deep in this with Carilion.
Yeah, absolutely. Catherine, I'm glad you brought that up. Bill, I'm glad you brought that up, because work-based learning, that catch-all term, which takes into a lot of things, mentorship, apprenticeships, externships, pick a word, but it is all about work-based learning. And the point, I think, around the minimum wage is that we have to look at that as a starting point. Yeah. Employers have committed over the last 5 or 6 years from a cultural standpoint to engage with our school systems, our community colleges, and our four-year institutions in more work-based learning. That is absolutely a standard now for career pathway development. So I think that if we were to sort of reorient our view on this debate about the minimum wage, I think it's incumbent upon employers and schools to work together to actually paint the picture for the career progression and the earning potential that individuals would have at any stage of life. And I'm not talking about only youth. I'm talking about adults who may be interested in career switching and continuing their professional journey.
Yeah, sounds like Cynthia and Bill are going to get together after the radio program. Mike?
You know, Dana, you mentioned the term life skills, which is a term I'm really fond of paying attention to. I spent decades volunteering in the Boy Scout organization, including here at the Blue Ridge Mountains Council on their board. And half of those youth, both male and female now in that organization, half of those youth advance through programs that are meant to promote and teach life skills. Half of those merit badges available to those youth are life skills merit badges, exactly what you're talking about here, that can link to an employer's need. So we have avenues now. So maybe employers could link decisions about what to pay to the skills that these folks are bringing to the job.
Right. Yeah, Wayne.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about what Catherine was saying. I worked with Junior Achievement for over 16 years and had a great time, but I was teaching third graders and fifth graders, and we talked about financial literacy. And I think, and I may be wrong, but I think the Commonwealth of Virginia requires financial literacy before you graduate. And they also are doing things such as lowering the age for internships. I understand it's now at 16 as opposed to 18, which will open up opportunities for lots of younger folks.
Yeah, it sounds that way. Bill.
I'm trying to think how many years ago I was invited to Pasadena High School to speak to, I think, about six classes. I think they were 9th, 10th graders. And when we talk about being successful and stuff like that. And so I put on the board, how many of you plan to be millionaires before you leave this planet? And all the fellas said, man, Remley, if we just can make it to the NBA and make it to the NFL, I said, you don't have to get there to be a millionaire. So I put on the board, if you make $50,000 a year over 20 years, you make $1 million. It blew them away. They could not. And I named all of the jobs, welders, electricians, plumbers, police officers, people who, $50,000 was not a lot of money to make. But they were capped in their minds as minimum wage people. And I'm just convinced. This has excited me. So people anywhere in Northwest, listen to this, anywhere in the city, please hear me. You can be a millionaire in this life. You don't have to stop at $15 an hour. Let the $15 get you going to the $1 million. It's not as hard as you think. You just got to try.
You got to start somewhere,
yeah.
Right? And I thought you were going to say, Bill, that the hardest way to make $1 million is to be in the NBA because the likelihood of you doing that is so small.
So small.
So
it is.
So, Mike.
I want to come back to the idea that employers who entertain increasing the wages for their employees, I want to come back to the point that they have an impact that they have to deal with when wages go up. Either the wages go up because it's imposed by legislation or the wages go up because they do it. And I've been reading about this subject recently, again, in the hospitality industry, the one that's most affected by this discussion. And it turns out, according to the studies I've read, for every 10% you raise somebody's wage in that industry, the costs to the employer only go up by a fraction of 1%. All right? In other words, the wage fraction of what the employer deals with to be successful is a relatively small piece of their business model. So if raising a minimum wage can help an employer retain employees and it only costs them a small fraction of their total cost to doing business, isn't that a good, sound business decision, whether the government forces you to do it or not?
Well, I think you make a good point. I think we're going to have to leave it there. Our time is up for today. Again, you're listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project Radio. You can follow us at roanokecollaboration.org. We've been discussing the minimum wage story on Radio IQ, and you can hear us on Radio Melrose. Thank you for tuning in.